First up on this edition is a segment on ethics. Somebody said that we will not survive the 21st century with the morals of the 20th. And Toynbee studied 20 dominant civilizations in history and concluded that Western civilization is the first with no agreed answer to the meaning of life. And this means that we have no agreed basis on which to build our morality. No God, no maker, no meaning, no ethics. In 1936, Unwin wrote his famous book on sex and culture. And he did a study of 10 civilizations and over 200 tribes and discovered that high cultural achievement always goes with a certain sexual discipline and restraints. Israel's strict sexual codes account for the enormous cultural energy in their society. Even more recently, names like Disraeli, Einstein, Freud, Marx, they weren't practicing Jews, but they came from the Jewish tradition. And what was released in the way of cultural creativity, whether we agree with them or not, was enormous. Unwin goes on to say, only one generation will be able to eat their cake and keep it. They live on their parents' cultural capital, like perfume from an empty bottle. Then cultural deterioration begins as sexual discipline disappears. And of course, Unwin's study about sex is true on all the other ethical frontiers that we are engaging at the moment. I've got, I think, about 8 points scribbled down here, and I'll go through them one by one. First, ethics is the new battlefront for the church. With the rise of liberal theology in the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th century, particularly among evangelicals, was the battle for the Bible. And fortunately, we threw lots of great scholars into the fray, and in many sense, we won that battle. Growing seminaries, growing churches around the world are evangelical, charismatic institutions. However, the battle today, in the latter part of the 20th century and the beginning of the 21st, is not about doctrine, but about ethics. The battlefront has changed. In the 16th century, if I was an Anabaptist, I could be imprisoned and executed for my view on baptism. That is very unlikely to happen in the 21st century, but very likely I could be imprisoned for my views on sexuality. Somebody said that we move from the unthinkable to the debatable to the acceptable. And of course that's true in areas like abortion, homosexuality, euthanasia, genetic engineering, bestiality, and so on. From the unthinkable to the debatable to the acceptable. And in fact now here in the States there's the National Association of Man-Boy Love encouraging sexual relationships between adolescent boys and men. Recently I discovered that Amazon.com carries three books advocating bestiality, some of them even giving intimate details about sexual activity between people and animals. And so all of these things that were unthinkable are now moving into the area of the debatable, and many of them indeed have reached the level of acceptability. It's interesting also that one of our cultural icons is that of autonomy, coming from, of course, the two words, auto meaning self and nomos meaning law. So it's simply self-law, because we've forsaken biblical absolutes and every man is doing what is right in his own eyes. Some time ago, a study was done on practicing lawyers and doctors, and they were asked if when they were in graduate school, they ever cheated on a major examination. And 63% of the lawyers said yes, and 68% of the doctors said that yes, they did indeed cheat, which you may not want to think about next time you go into surgery. So number one, ethics is the new battlefront for the church. Not that the battle for the Bible has disappeared, but certainly we've gained a lot of traction on that front. But it seems now that we are called to fight very aggressively in the arena of ethics. Number two, ethics and morals are not the same. Ethics is what's called a normative science and has to do with foundations, imperatives, oughts, what one ought to do, and basics. Morals is a descriptive science to do with mores, customs, not what ought to be done, but what is being done. Now ethics, the oughts, what we ought to do, ethics always determined morals. Now things have got flipped upside down. Now morals, mores, what is being done, determines ethics. In other words, we discover what people are doing and then we construct our ethic. If it's normal, quote, unquote, it's okay. When the Kinsey report came out, which was so influential in the sexual revolution that began in the 60s, 73% said they believed that premarital sex was okay. Therefore, it is okay. If it's normal, then it's okay. And so we're reduced really to statistical morality. The opinion of the majority is the only alternative to biblical absolutes. So ethics and morals are not the same. It used to be that ethics determined morals. Now morals, mores, what is being done, is determining our ethics. And statistical morality is ruling the day. Number three, ethics and law are not the same. Ethics is obedience to the unenforceable, whereas law is obedience to the enforceable. Perhaps just a small illustration will help. Let's say I'm going grocery shopping and I notice that there's one grocery cart left and there's a little 90-year-old lady tottering towards it, and I start running and sprint towards the shopping cart, reach it just before her and take it for my own needs. Now that's unethical, but it's not unlawful. Law is obedience to the enforceable. In other words, one would have to have a total police state if everything that was unethical was also unlawful. However, when we lose our ethical consciousness, basic decency and kindness, the amount of litigation in a society increases. And perhaps that's why today, in the States, we have become the most litigious society in history. Normally, things are solved simply by basic neighbor love, decency, and kindness. And that's an ethic that pervades a society. When that breaks down, we have to bring in more and more law because we've lost our ethical consciousness, and the amount of litigation in a society then just explodes. Number four, ethics is now leveraged by technology and indeed somewhat obscured by technology. The knowledge of the useful is preferred above the knowledge of the good and the true. And in fact, we now confuse means with ends. Technology, which comes from the word technique, is a means. And we're in danger of confusing means with ends. But the fascinating thing for me is that how today, uniquely, ethics is leveraged by technology. It amplifies ethical decisions, and they get kind of megaphoned into world consequences, whether they be human cloning, genetic engineering, nuclear technology, and so on. Somebody asked, if you were living 100 years ago, how much damage could you do in one night? Now, I suppose you might be able to dynamite or shell several hundred homes, but that would be about it, the amount of damage you could do in one night. But on April 26, 1989, in the Ukraine, reactor number 6 at Chernobyl went into meltdown. Now, there were 6 alarm systems that had been deliberately overridden, and there were valves padlocked in the open position. We don't know quite what was going on at Chernobyl that night, whether it was some sort of very dangerous experimentation, but it was not a simple accident. And researchers say there's definitely been some sort of cover-up. It was an ethical decision that led to the meltdown of reactor number 6. Now, that ethical decision that night, of course, is so leveraged by the technology involved. In fact, now the reactor is encased in concrete, and it will be radioactive for as long as the pyramids have existed. And so we're now living in an age where not only is ethics the new battlefront, but it's very much being leveraged by technology. Decisions can be made that can have consequences for millions of lives, and indeed for generations to come. Number 5, ethics are not globally relative. Of course, everybody says that they are, but indeed they are not. The mantra in the 60s was that it is forbidden to forbid. In other words, you can do anything and everything, but you can't do one thing, and that's forbid me to do it. It's forbidden to forbid. And there's an institute for global ethics in California, which is a very kind of high octane think tank. They do a lot of work globally, and they published a couple of years ago the results of their work, having studied hundreds of societies around the world. And they came up with 5 common denominators that they found in every society. Now, that there might be more than 5, but these 5 were always there. Number 1 was compassion and caring. Number 2 was truth, honesty, and integrity. Number 3 was justice. Number 4 was responsibility and accountability. And number 5 was respect and human dignity. Now, the interesting thing, of course, is that it's very easy to parallel every one of those five to the commandments. And so number one, compassion and caring, simply anchors into loving one's neighbour as oneself. Number two, truth, honesty and integrity, anchors into commandment number seven, don't commit adultery, and commandment number nine, don't give false witness. And number three, justice, anchors into the Sabbath, commandment number four, and again into commandment number nine, about not giving false witness. In fact, in Exodus 23:12 and Deuteronomy 5:14, the Sabbath is spoken of as a mechanism of social justice. In other words, you pay somebody for 7 days, but they only work for 6 days, so that they can have time to rest and to be with their families. And particularly in Exodus and Deuteronomy, it's speaking about hired labor or slaves. So number one, compassion and caring. Number two, truth, honesty, integrity. Number three, justice. Number four, responsibility and accountability. That anchors, of course, into the 10th commandment about not coveting, being responsible and accountable. And number eight, not stealing. And of course, nobody takes their five-year-old to school and says to the teacher, please teach my child to steal. It simply isn't done in any society. We might steal, okay, but we know that it's wrong. And number five, respect and human dignity. Commandment number five, honor your father and your mother. And of course, six, not taking human life, not killing, because we respect human rights and human dignity. And so indeed, the law is written on the hearts. And however much we might be told that ethics are completely relative, the empirical data shows that indeed they are not. People may break all these things, but deep in the heart and embedded in society is a belief that human behavior should be guided by these ethical principles. Number six, having said that ethics is the new battlefront for the church, ethics is also the new opportunity for the church. A couple of examples. Let's look at the growth of the Mormon church. Now, Mormon doctrine is bizarre, and very few people become Mormons because of their doctrine. Why do they become Mormons? Because their neighbor or their colleague at work or a relative is such a good person, such an ethical person, such a compassionate person. And they are using ethics, the breakdown of ethics, as an opportunity to advance the cause of Mormonism. In the first century, when somebody asked, "How do I know that the gospel is true?" they often had a very simple answer. They would often say, "Look at the lives of the Christians." And the way they lived was their apologetic. Henry Chadwick, the historian, concludes that the practical application of charity was the most potent single cause of Christian success in the ancient world. This was not surprising, as almsgiving was virtually unknown among the Greeks. The German theologian, George Kretschmar, said that in the final analysis, it was not the miracles of the early church that impressed people. Miracle workers were a familiar phenomenon in the ancient world, but it was the conduct of the Christians, the propaganda of the deed, that had such impact. Christians were unbelievably generous with their money and in their compassionate acts for the needy and disenfranchised. Now, I think that Kretschmar is overstating the case because we certainly learn from church history that it was not only their compassion for the poor, but it was also signs and wonders, and indeed also the blood of the martyrs. But having said that, Chadwick and Kretschmar do indeed have an important point. In the 4th century, Basil the Great was so moved by the needs of the poor that he built a city on the outskirts of Caesarea devoted to providing medical care for the sick, shelter for travellers, clothing for the poor, and work for the unemployed. In describing Basil's work, Gregory instructs his friends to go a little way forth from the city, that's Caesarea, and behold the new city, the storehouse of piety, the common treasury for the poor, in which that which was superfluous to the wealthy was stored, so that they could minister comprehensively and holistically to the poor of their age. And so ethics, yes, it is the new battlefront, but it's also the new opportunity for the church, that again our lives become our apologetic. Our lives speak forth the truthfulness of the gospel. Doesn't mean to say that we abandon conventional apologetics, but people are somewhat kind of world weary, and they want to see it incarnated in a community of people. And that's indeed what the early church did. Number 7, ethics and behavior are as important as data and doctrine in underpinning our witness before a watching world. Tragically, we've separated belief from behavior. And now, here in the States, the divorce rate among evangelicals is higher than in the population at large. What's happened? We've separated belief from behavior. The Jews have often criticized Christians, saying that you, that is us Christians, you have a belief, whereas we have a way, a lifestyle, what they call halakha. And yet, of course, we know when we read the book of Acts, and that the early Christians, before they were ever called Christians, were simply called follower of the way, because they were those that did not separate belief from behavior and sought to be imitators of Christ in the way that they lived and walked. But now our data beliefs must become our control beliefs. You're probably aware that many sociologists have made this distinction between what they call control beliefs and data beliefs. Control beliefs are volitional, having to do with the will, whereas data beliefs are cognitive, having to do more with the mind. Control beliefs are motivational, to do with behavior, whereas data beliefs can be simply prepositional. Control beliefs are what we might call visceral. They're our gut-level beliefs, whereas data beliefs can be simply intellectual. Control beliefs, we might say, have to do with our hands and feet, how we behave, how we live, whereas data beliefs have to do with the head and the heart, not the hands and the feet, but the head and the heart. Not so much behavior, but some belief in that cognitive, prepositional sense. Now, often as Christians, we say, well, he believes that with his head, but not with his heart. And that's not what they're saying. You see, a data belief is something you believe with your head and with your whole heart. In other words, some Christians, they believe with all their hearts that fornication is wrong. They believe with all their heart that fraud is wrong. However, they don't necessarily live without ever getting into fornication and fraud. They still believe it, that it's wrong, with all their hearts, but they simply don't practice it. At a point of temptation, it is not what controls them. When they're under pressure, they are not their control beliefs. Control beliefs have to do with action. Data beliefs have to do with intention. It's what we intend to do, but tragically, often we don't do it. And the critical factor, because ethics is the new battlefront, is to close the gap between control beliefs and data beliefs. There should be no gap between them. And of course, as we look in the life of Jesus, the two are perfectly fused. As we look in the life of the early church wasn't perfect, but there wasn't the yawning gap that is so big that even sociologists have spotted it between control and data beliefs in our own day. So this gap must be closed. And then finally, perhaps on a slightly lighter note, it's been said that mealtime has always been the moment of ethical discourse. And of course in Deuteronomy 6, speaking of God's commandments, it says that you should talk of them with your sons and daughters, when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you tuck them into bed, and when you rise up, and so on and so forth. And what they're really saying is much of what we believe ethically is passed on informally. Of course, we want Sunday school classes, etc., but so much from one generation to the other is simply absorbed by these informal moments of ethical discourse, where around the meal table we'll simply unpack the events of the day that happened at work or happened at college or happened in the school, and we're really making ethical judgments about those things. But having said that, the average high schooler in the States now eats an average of 2 meals a week with their parents, because usually both parents are working, the kids are out at sporting events, or they're working after school, and less is a family actually physically together to have a meal together. And so that crucial moment of ethical discourse is being lost, and we need to regain it. Well, that was a little bit rambly, but we're all aware of the tremendous ethical pressure we are under in the West as Christians, and so I wanted to pass on that kind of miscellany of thinking, and you can add your own to it. And if you want to respond to me or add to anything I've said, I would appreciate it.